Ray, Jen Cooper, the Keeper here for the next episode of the Mixed Zone Women's Soccer Podcast. This is podcast number 90. And 1990 was a significant year for the U.S. Women's National Team. It was the first year that the team won every match they played, defeating Norway, England, Germany, Canada, and Yugoslavia. Yep, it was called Yugoslavia back then. And an 18-year-old Mia Hamm scored her very first international goal. So two chats today. First, I recap the inaugural She Believes Cup with Charlie Boehm of Soccer Wire. We also talk about preparation for the Olympics, field quality issues, and the future of this domestic tournament. Then Hal Kaiser and I talk NWSL preseason. It's the fourth preseason for NWSL, and that's a great thing. I also get the skinny from Hal on the WK League in Korea. Jen Cooper, the Keeper, here with Charlie Boehm from a multitude of websites covering soccer. Of course, we've got Soccer Wire, MLSsoccer.com, and USsoccerplayers.com, all great places to find soccer news. And Charlie, you write for all of them.
Oh, and I forgot I'm doing stuff for 442 here and there now, too, which is a very exciting new project. They just opened up their U.S. operation, run by our good friend Jeff Kasouf.
Which is so awesome. I've picked up that magazine many times in kind of a, you know, specialty newsstand, you know, and it's just a beautiful magazine, you know, serious coverage of soccer. I was excited when they, you know, said that they were going to do something in the U.S. But before we get distracted by all this soccer media, let's talk She Believes Cup. You know, first tournament in the books, U.S., the champions, you know, it's funny. It's one of those tournaments that I think is just so U.S., where you could look at each game and say, wow, that wasn't the best game for them, but they always find a way to win.
Yeah, you know, I think it's a testament to them. There's a lot of negatives, or there's a healthy number of negatives, I think, to chew on from this, from the performance standpoint for the U.S. But, you know, I can, when I step back for a minute and just consider what it must be like to play them, it must be an absolute nightmare. I mean, they're win, lose, or draw. You're going to get worked physically. You're going to have to chase a lot. And even when they play badly, they always seem to come up with important goals at important times to pull out results. They do have the that winning mentality that we've heard so much about with, you know, a strength that American players traditionally have had. And you see it with this squad, whether it's just momentum or collective experience or whatever it may, however you want to, you know, diagnose it, they just don't lose very often, and they deserve credit for that.
And the depth that they have coming off the bench in a tournament like this, much like the Algarve, it's not limited to three subs the way that an Olympic match or Women's World Cup match would be limited. So, you know, that extra depth, you know, is really, really a great advantage for the U.S., especially when, well, let's talk about Alex Morgan's goal, because that was, I mean, who would have thought that there'd be something to top Crystal Dunn's goal against England for the tournament? But then, I mean, at that Alex goal, especially with the little somersault at the end, where she kind of had that look like, yeah, I meant to do that.
Yeah, well, I assume you're referring to the Germany goal.
Yeah.
But she deserves a ton of credit for the calm finish to win the game against France as well, which is maybe more of a team goal with a really nice ball laid through by the youngster, Mal Pugh. But Morgan was just, yeah, it was a little bit of old school women's national team for me. A long ball catching the defense out a bit, direct play being rewarded. With Morgan, you know, that's still her bread and butter. She's added a lot to her toolkit of late. She's worked very hard to become a more complete number nine type striker, which is what the system that they're playing now asks of her. But when it comes down to it, she is most comfortable and most dangerous in the open field, terrorizing defenders, creating athletic matchups and 1v1 matchups, and then pulling out that little ingenious bit of world-class finishing at the end. Really, really great stuff, and weathering a very physical challenge, which I think she probably saw waiting for her, and you know, has to hit the deck and still get the ball in the back of the net, which she did.
And you know, there's got to be the thought in the back of her mind of, you know, the injuries she's been wrestling with, you know, the last 2.5 years, but
she went into that challenge full on and came out of it, you know, just like, yep, no big deal. And I think that was a great thing for all of us to see, where, because she's been so fragile, you know, and so I think she is returning to that form, that kind of 2012, 2013 form that we've been missing.
Yeah, and I think a great test, even though, you know, we're going to talk a little bit, I think, about the scheduling choices that the U.S. staff has made in the lead up to this Olympics, and you are arguably taking a risk by playing at home at this juncture rather than going and playing in the Algarve against a litany of good teams. But I think there's just no replacing for this team the value of a game like that against Germany, where both teams have to deal with, you know, tropical conditions and a really sloppy pitch. A real edge to that game, I thought. It was more than a friendly. It was more than a meaningless tournament, with some of the physical contact and the kind of that pugnacious approach from some of the German defenders. So for someone like Morgan to come good in that situation and battle through all that stuff is impressive. Because I remember thinking, watching firsthand in the Olympic final in Houston against Canada, physical play did knock her off her game and did maybe force her brain away from the match a little bit, if that makes sense. And so to see her hang in there with a little bit more doggedness against Germany was impressive.
Well, and I like to, you know, to talk about the scheduling, because I think one of the advantages of She Believes is that they got to determine their opponents for all three matches. So you go into the Algarve, you know that it's going to be top opponents, but there's a draw, and you don't know who you're going to face in that fourth game. It all is dependent on what happens in games 1, 2, and 3. So when you look back at the history of the Algarve Cup, U.S. and Germany have only met 4 times in the 20 tournaments that they've both been in, and it's always been the final. You know, they've missed each other a lot of times because they've always been in separate groups, but, you know, maybe one makes the final and one doesn't. You know, so here you've got 3 matches where you get all the top teams. You know, not saying that Algarve isn't the most competitive thing outside the Women's World Cup and the Olympics, but I feel like it's a little bit closer to the pacing of the Olympics, where it's a game every 3 days as opposed to that every other day.
Yeah, and it's also, I think it's a statement of intent to some extent, implicitly for your fans. We want these teams to come here and play in front of American kids and American supporters, who, so they understand this is the competition. This is the level that we are aiming at, that we have to test ourselves against, not patsies in sort of glorified homecoming ceremony type of games where the fans are there to soak up a celebrity experience rather than an elite, world-class, world-elite level sort of matchup on the field.
Yeah, there is, I like that, there is a fan education element to it where, you know, these were all incredibly close games. You know, no game was decided by more than one goal, you know, and the U.S. was losing to Germany for a bit. And I think that's a more accurate representation of, you know, what teams have to go through to prepare for the Olympics and, you know, and a World Cup. That, you know, beating Trinidad 5-0 is not necessarily good preparation, you know, for the big games. But also about being in front of your home fans, one of the things that concerns me when I look back at games leading up to the Women's World Cup and previous Olympics, usually the team factors in one, if not two or more, international trips to kind of prepare themselves for, you know, making a big trip to somewhere like Brazil. Now, obviously, I can see why they don't want to go to Brazil, you know, right now. But when we look at last year leading up to the Women's World Cup, they had the trip to Brazil in December. Then they were at England, at France, in Portugal, getting tough games against tough opponents, not in front of their home fans. Now, we look at this year, they haven't been in a foreign country since the Women's World Cup. And you can hardly qualify that as foreign when, you know, they had full support of everyone in the stadium every game they played, you know. So I wonder what that takes away from the preparation for the Olympics, where, you know, we haven't done the draw yet, but, you know, they're probably not going to play many of their games in Rio. They could end up having situations like they did when they played in Brazil in 2014, where you know, you're playing in front of a crowd of 500, you know, because not that people wouldn't be interested in women's soccer, but that the organization of these Olympics could be sloppy, as we've seen in previous tournaments.
Even if things go best case scenario, you know, you're still looking at some really enormous venues. I think the finals, or at least more than one, I think, of the latter games in this tournament are going to be at the Maracanã in Rio, which is just a cavernous venue. It's hard for any team or matchup to fill that type of place. So it is, yeah, I'm not expecting very much, sadly, from the, sort of infrastructure and advertising and promotion of these games, because you know we're still looking at a country in Brazil that's not necessarily fully flipped the switch in terms of the women's game.
You know, and I don't know what the travel will be like in terms of non-Brazilians coming to these Olympics. How many people are going to be making the trip? I always go back to the Olympics in Athens in 2004, where there were so many events, not just soccer, events across the board where you're like, wow, that's a lot of blue seats that are watching these games. You know, there's a lot of open seats there because they were just so behind on building some of the infrastructure, and getting tickets sold and stuff like that. But my larger point is, you know, has this team really done much to prepare for what's it like to play in front of people that aren't rooting for you or know people, or after you've, taken that 10-hour flight? And, I don't know how important that is, but just looking back at their preparation in the past, it seems like something the teams tend to do a lot. And I would think that, that's why Germany was like, hey, this is a great tournament. This is a great preparation, to come to She Believes and to play in front of fans that aren't rooting for them, but it's clearly a highly competitive environment. I wonder what we lose by not having any foreign trips.
Yeah, the issue is, I think there's a couple factors here. One, it's unavoidable that there's a financial component to this. And
right.
We just saw last week what those numbers look like. There's a very real financial penalty to taking, which is not how it should be for the number one ranked team in the world, the defending World Cup champions. They should be able to get a healthy crowd in multiple locations around the world. But the rest of the world is still not at that point. And so then there becomes a financial cost to traveling rather than being here at home. So I think you have to say there's only so much you can do as a federation in this situation. They've are set to reap literally a record haul financially from, a year or two or a year and a half or so of world champions playing at home. And how much can you, where can you go abroad that can really set you up with a sort of challenge that might, worst case scenario, I guess, might happen to you in the Brazil Olympics? Maybe you play Brazil, wind up playing Brazil at home in a match of consequence, a knockout match. Well, that's tough, but that's probably the only match I could see really creating an actively hostile environment that would be anything troubling to this group of professionals, and I think in general they probably trust that their culture, their team culture, will have them prepare for that and rise to any kind of occasion that is more difficult than the norm.
Yeah, I just wonder about some of the younger players, especially since we are seeing more of a transition than we originally had expected for this Olympic cycle. And I'm not trying to go looking for bad things, but I wonder. Where it's like, think of the people that have just been capped basically since the victory tour. They've only experienced these loud, large, very pro USA, crowds. And, that's gotta be a transition. But I think you're right that the team culture is something that helps this team in a way that maybe we don't see with other teams, that regardless of all these other things happening around us, we're going to find a way to win. I heard a great quote from Anson Dorrance years ago. He talked about, there's two opponents in every match. There's the other team, and then there's the actual game itself, whether that means weather or a bad referee or, something that's just working against you. So he always trained the girls to think about, you've got two opponents. It's not just the other team, so... Yeah, there's certainly the mentality in this team of like, regardless of what's out there, we're going to take it down.
Mm-hmm. But, and you have to credit the coaching staff again for for creating an environment where, well, it could probably, this is probably a fun topic unto itself, you know, is every player being pushed, and maybe not quite to the ultimate because of the marketing power, the reputation, the weight that carries here, but definitely I'd say most of the starting 11 has someone over their shoulder, ready and willing to step in and bring a similar or even a greater amount to the squad. So there's, you know, I would love to see a U.S. women's national team B team entered in the Algarve or something, or a split squad, and see how the second 11 does, because I think it'd be pretty impressive.
Though Portugal, the federation did make it pretty clear after 2001 when they brought basically a B/C squad, you know, because they left all of the senior players with their WSA teams. They said, you do that again, we're never inviting you back. But of course now, with the U.S. doing She Believes, you know, maybe the Portuguese Federation would change their mind. Be like, yeah, we'd be happy to have a team. You know? I mean, you think about what if Brazil had a B team for the men's, you know? Like, they would both make the World Cup.
Well, I would pay, you know, from a fan's perspective, I don't see why you wouldn't pay good money to watch that B team too, because they could thrash the vast majority of the world's national teams.
Yeah, totally. Well, what do you think's going to happen with U.S. soccer going forward with She Believes? They've made it clear that they want to do it at least, what, 2-3 more years? You know, and they had some nice success this year in terms of, you know, decent crowds. I was a little concerned that having two games on ESPN3, so it's not broadly done, and then you couldn't even watch the games that weren't USA games. But what do you think?
Yeah, that was disappointing. I think you also get into a question of whether how much the federation could or should extend themselves financially for that sort of access. Again, like it'd be great. I think there's a market out there that should be consuming those games, you know, the other half of these doubleheaders. But this is a canny, conservative, financially savvy federation that probably decided not to spend too many dimes to bring, you know, those to spend the money, I guess, on infrastructure.
Yeah,
but
I'm going to call bullshit. I'm going to call bullshit on that. When we know the TV crews are there, we know there's a world feed. The game was being streamed, just not here. So it's like that's a matter of setting up YouTube.
Yeah, that's a good point. And they have done this for the youth national team on multiple occasions, multiple youth national teams to broadcast, whether it's the Nike friendlies that the U17s play in or whatnot. So I think there's a good point there.
I mean, clearly Germany and France paid for rights. So I know they probably can't just put it up on YouTube, because then that would kind of, you know, take away. But there's got to be a way they can geo-block it or something. But it's just, It's sad when you know the demand's there and you know the game is being televised. You know, unlike some of the Algarve Cups, you knew that there weren't any cameras there. You know, so there wasn't a choice about that. Or there were, but like one of the games last year, I think it was US-Iceland, that the lighting was just so poor because it was one of the smaller, you know, cheaper stadiums. You know, mm-hmm. But it's the kind of thing. Yeah, there's a cost to it. I know there's cost to broadcast, but when you know the game is being broadcast somewhere, it's like, fine. You know, it doesn't have to have the announcers. I mean, you can do the world feed where it already has just one person talking or something like that. But it's just.
Oh, I love the feed. I love the no audio, the no broadcaster audio, strictly game microphones feeds. Those are lovely. You can get those for Champions League games.
Uh-huh.
Fox, and to me there's a zen bliss in having have only the crowd and occasionally some field mics picking up player noise, you know, and no commentary. Even though there's, you know, no disrespect to our colleagues in the commentary business, the play-by-play men and women, most of them do a great job, but there's something soothing about just the sounds of the game. So I would definitely consume that stream, but I suspect that there may be a compromise to be made here when you are bringing in top teams like this, and you know, German and French federations and that level have certain needs and demands that they bring into these games.
Right.
But it's true, it would be fun to see what kind of traffic a stream would get, you know, and you'd think they picked up a lot of knowledge doing that for that sort of thing for NWSL for a few years now. You know, we shall wait. This is another thing where I'm going to say something politically incorrect now in this soccer world, but I know I laud people who take a hard stance against any kind of quote unquote illegal streaming. And I do the same myself wherever it is possible, but this is where you sort of hit the limits and I find it a little bit silly or unfair to lambast fans who are consuming streams via informal methods for moments like this, where there's simply the system as it stands does not provide you a waiting customer with the services or the entertainment you need. And so how can you blame a fan for especially a hungry WOSO fan here in the States for going out and finding a stream somewhere, some way to watch these games that are happening on American soil that are of a high level?
Yeah, and that's such a great point, because it's not like someone is, you know, choosing not to subscribe to some service and getting it illegally. There is no way to get it legally, you know, so...
It reminds me of the MP3 landscape a few years ago, you know, maybe a decade or so ago now, where you have a moral prerogative or an ideal situation, and unfortunately there's no way to get what you need and while still adhering to that sort of purity. But everybody has to make their own individual choices on that.
Yeah. I mean, I was kind of waiting for someone to just periscope it from the stands, though that would probably be painful in its own way.
I'm sure NWSL fans would say they experienced worse in the first year or two.
But yeah,
that actually did happen in an MLS preseason game. Believe it or not, there's now a growing enough hardcore population of MLS fans who will consume preseason games. And I think it was one of the games that tournaments down in Arizona, and the Sounders had tech issues, so one of their communications people went up to the top of the stands and periscope the game as best they could, and they still had a couple thousand people consuming that.
Right, and it reminds me of when I went down to Port of Spain for that last Trinidad versus Ecuador Women's World Cup qualifier, and they did have two video streams of the game, but they kept crashing. So I was doing just audio via Mixlr, and I mean, I was getting great response because, you know, people couldn't watch otherwise, and if they couldn't get video, they were happy to have audio. You know, because it was capturing the all the ambient sounds, and, you know, and I could alert them to subs and give a sense of the whole, you know, just what was going on. But yeah, that surprised me, the number of people, you know, of course, who were not from Trinidad and not from Ecuador, but because the story had taken hold, were just curious as to what was going to happen. So yeah, there's so much potential there. And I don't know what the answer is in terms of getting more access for people. I mean, I understand the broadcast costs, and you don't necessarily want to put that burden on U.S. soccer, but when you know that other people have paid for the rights and those games are being broadcast somewhere, it's like there's got to be a way, you know. And thank God for YouTube that some kind souls do end up putting these games up after the fact, so at least you can watch it later. But, you know, we all want to watch things live as they're happening. You don't want to have it spoiled for you that, oh yeah, yeah, that's what happened, that's the score. Well, let's also talk what happens in the future in terms of Algarve Cup and Cyprus Cup. So, I mean, this is really taking away, you know, four great teams from the Algarve, you know, the U.S. and whoever they'll invite each year. You know, and the Algarve Cup has always been kind of the top tournament for this time of year, followed by the Cyprus Cup. Now, an additional challenge this year, of course, was that Asia was doing their Olympic qualifying, so that took six teams, and Europe had its Olympic playoff, so that took four great teams. So you won't have those next year. So I think, you know, Algarve might be able to return to the 12-team format that had been the tradition for the last several years. But you know, it's very much a changing landscape.
Right, and I think my guess is that most players would say, hey, give me wherever it is that we have to go, give me a bigger crowd, better opposition, you know, a new and different stage, and then from a federation standpoint, you know, maybe a more lucrative payday. I suspect that that the U.S. made it worth the while of France, Germany, and England to come over for this event. You know, it's good to see, I guess, credit to the Algarve's founders and managers for, you know, creating something like that and keeping it going. But to some extent, you know, it's time that there be challenges out there that sort of push others along and raise the level across the board.
Well, and last topic for She Believes, you know, we saw the picture of the field that Hope Solo tweeted Tuesday before that final game. Didn't look very good, though at the same time there was a picture tweeted from the walkthrough a couple of the other players where it looked behind them looked like it was pretty nice green grass. But then when we saw on the broadcast, it did look pretty rough. It's that kind of thing, like, you know, who's saying it always affects how we take the statement of, you know, this field is horrible. But in the context of what happened in the fall with all the turf and then the you know, the current legal situation, you know, what do you get from that tweet?
So, lot to digest here. One, I think we should have full transparency in as much as possible about the information, the circumstances of these games. So, credit to Hope Solo, regardless of her motives, for making it an issue as she believed that it should have been. I suppose you could say we would have all figured it out eventually once the game started, right. But she wants to make, you know, encourage an atmosphere of credibility or accountability. Sorry. It's okay. You know, that's a great, great step toward transparency, whether it's coming from a fan, a player, a federation official, whatever it may be. Let's talk about this ideally before the game so that if something can be changed, you know, it can be. That wasn't necessarily that, you know, it's a grass surface that to me looked like it had gotten chewed up the tail end of the gridiron football season,
right?
Probably last fall, and then maybe never quite recovered or wasn't properly maintained and rehabilitated. Because what I saw was really heavy wear zones along the what would be the gridiron sidelines, where you have large men in full pads standing and pacing around, right? So the alleys, the channels along in front of the benches and on the opposite sideline there, which are, you know, not right in the center, I guess, but there are certainly places where important moments happen in matches were bad and they were tough to play through. They were, you know, creating unpredictability there and possibly creating injury risks. That said, you know, these are the risks that come with a natural surface. And we saw the risks of a synthetic surface out in Hawaii on the Victory Tour, and now you see the flip side here. I don't totally agree with the idea, the assumption that this is a gender equity matter, which is what Hope strongly hinted at. Because I've seen the men play on some pretty poor surfaces, almost all of them, due to Jürgen Klinsmann, you know, having an allergy to synthetic surfaces, or the team that the U.S. men are playing not wanting to play on a synthetic surface, and therefore a temporary sod pitch gets laid down over it. And that's been a recipe for disaster here. I've seen some unpleasant and downright dangerous conditions created there. There's any number of examples. There was a dangerous such pitch in Vancouver a few years ago. Seattle consistently struggles. And then the U.S. played Mexico in a big game. It was a friendly, but still a big game against Mexico at the Alamo Dome in San Antonio, Texas.
They were complaining about the turf in December. And I remember talking about that the teams almost didn't come out of the locker room because the grass turf that they had brought in to put over the synthetic was just so horribly poor. And it's like, that's more dangerous in some ways.
It is not impossible to put down a quality grass surface on a temporary basis,
right,
over turf. But all too often, the people that make the decisions about that and how much is spent on it are the promoters or the event hosts, you know, the venue itself, which inevitably they don't have the same motivation to quality control. They're counting pennies much more than players or federations there. So I've seen good ones put down, and the one in San Antonio was really poor. It looked bad. It played badly. I do think it doesn't just create a risk of serious injuries. It has a effect on the players' sort of fitness and fatigue levels. It's just a harder match to play on those. So when the women, it's really important that we point out when we hear talk of the, you know, I don't know if this has been confirmed, but certainly strong suggestions that the women's national team refuses to play on turf at the moment. If that's what they're doing, and they share the federation's goal, which I think is a laudable one, of taking this team and the sport to new places that don't see it as often, right? Like New Orleans and Chattanooga. I think there's a good instinct there. And so if you're forcing those matches to take place on temporary grass surfaces, you're going to see similar or worse conditions to what you had down at FAU.
And the tough thing is when you bring in a temporary surface, or even, you know, maybe it's the surface from the previous season, even if you send somebody in a week before to do a walkthrough, there's not necessarily time to solve it. I mean, I've worked the Gold Cup in Houston multiple times, and you know, sometimes the field that they've brought in has been pristine and perfect, and one time it was horrific. But it's 3 days before the game. It's not like you can just run out and get another football field worth of amazingly great green soft turf. You know, it's not, it's a very difficult problem to solve. Like you were saying, a lot of the people at these venues where you have these games just coming in and out, they're not necessarily tied to making sure that that grass is perfect. They're just trying to make sure that their costs are covered and, you know, that their venue does what it's supposed to do in terms of parking, concessions, bathrooms, that kind of thing. But yeah, it's like the field always seems to be an afterthought, and not just women's. I mean, I've seen it a lot in men's that it can be an afterthought.
And it's an area where, you know, to speak in generalities here, if you spend $100,000, you're going to get one set of results, or you're going to get a pretty poor synthetic, you know, temporary grass surface. Maybe you spend $300,000, you can have a really good one. Well, we can talk about the $200,000 being a small price to pay for the health and safety and performance of elite athletes. But from a promoter standpoint, that may have just eaten into half or a third or a big chunk of your actual take home from an event like this. The margins are tighter on these games than people realize. And I hope that those who studied in depth the budget figures that came out last week from the U.S. Soccer Federation notice that there are substantial costs with having these events. They're not guaranteed paydays. They have to get it right. They have to pick the right place. They have to get their financials and logistics right. Because a game that, you know, contributes to this 20 plus million dollar windfall that the Federation got, could just as easily, lead to losses if you don't, you know, do your business right.
And people have to buy tickets. You know, if they don't buy tickets, you don't have the money to do something. You look at that game in San Antonio for the women, it was just a little bit over 10,000, you know, and they're thinking, oh, they should have brought in grass. It's like, well, they brought in grass for the men's game there, but that game had sold out.
Right.
You know, 70,000.
The take pays for it.
Yeah, so the tickets paid for it. And I think that's the challenge, you know, that we're going to see for a while, you know, in women's soccer. And I also think I want to see more of these games, you know, work into MLS venues, because that's where, you know, that's where you do have a lot of really great grass surfaces. But whether it's a scheduling issue or perhaps U.S. soccer thinks some of those venues are too small, or, you know, it seemed like they used almost no MLS venues for the Victory Tour.
I think you have to find a balance here, and it is tough. When we look at, for example, the CONCACAF tournament in Houston and Dallas didn't really kill at the gate, but you have to look a little deeper there and recognize that CONCACAF is in charge of that. They didn't do a good job in setting their price points. They didn't spend a particularly significant amount of money on advertising and promotion.
There were no group tickets like there are for the women's friendlies.
Mm-hmm. And again, every time, you know, it's like at any level of the sport here in the U.S., whenever we see a small crowd, it causes this paroxysm of self-doubt and finger-pointing, because
the sky is falling. The sky is falling.
Right. I mean, for example, you know, CONCACAF Champions League matches on the men's side with MLS teams playing Mexican clubs in the knockout stages of that tournament over the past month or so, there were some really atrocious crowds. You know, the Sounders got a great crowd up in Seattle, as they usually do, but DC United had a pretty pitiful crowd here for a weeknight game against a lower-level Mexican club in terms of visibility. Well, CONCACAF set those ticket prices too, and they set them pretty high, and it made it something, and it's already in a tournament that's primarily of interest to hardcore supporters. So, you know, hopefully we can grow out of some of this built-in self-doubt that comes with that. But when you see a big crowd and you see a big event, you have to stop and give praise not only to the people that are involved with it on the field, but the people that work to make it so off the field. And that's something there are people out there doing it. It's just that they don't often get recognized for it.
Yeah, those tickets don't sell themselves, people.
Absolutely.
Well, Charlie, I know you've got some MLS work to do, so I want to let you go. But first, just any last thoughts on She Believes?
Well, like we said earlier, you know, it's great to see that this team still has that mentality and that strength to get a result. But I'll be watching with interest their matches to come in terms of the U.S. because What I was really impressed by, the sophistication of play and the passing rhythms that that Morgan Brian and Lindsey Horan got going in the midfield, and that their control of the game was really laudable during the CONCACAF tournament. And I thought it faded a bit. Those two players and the teams in general had a hard time against the next rung of quality opposition. You know, playing against Germany, they simply weren't able to build and weren't able to play at a speed of thought and tempo that I had hoped. And so, you know, great example of where even the best get challenged, and we saw a little bit of that old instinct to go long when things get tough in as you build out of the back. Again, they got the results, so you have to give them credit for that. But I'll be eager to see whether they can continue their sort of internal improvement. And this U.S. team so often has to gauge itself against itself and against a less tangible ideal of perfection, because Germany and France made it hard for them, you know. And I look forward to seeing if they can continue to evolve and play that pretty soccer, that controlling, dominating soccer we saw in the CONCACAF tournament against those high-level teams.
All right. Well, thanks for all your insight and feedback, Charlie, and we'll be talking to you again soon.
Always a pleasure, Jen.
All right. Jen Cooper, the keeper, here with Hal Kaiser, the keeper of keepernotes.com, our editor who makes everything run, and of course, the man who is the original beat reporter for an NWSL team. Hal, this is your third year, right?
Like, this is my third year. It's unbelievable. Yeah,
being at the first practice of the season, right?
Yeah, I was there. I said yesterday after the first day of Dash practice was over, there were eight people there yesterday who were there for the first day of practice ever. Four of them were players. Four of them were not players. I was one of the four that was not players.
Wow, that's going to be a club like the Super Bowl club of people who have been to every Super Bowl, you know, that gets smaller every year.
Yeah, exactly.
You're already
it's getting small fast, yeah. But it's great. I mean, because you've been there so much, so long that when the players come out, you know, you haven't seen each other since the end of the season. So it's all, hey, how's it going? You know, what was your off season? I mean, it's a very fun atmosphere.
Now, this is, of course, a historic preseason, and it's actual the fourth preseason for a women's pro soccer league.
Yeah.
We know WPS had a fourth draft, but never got to the point of having a fourth season. You know, Orlando has kicked off their preseason, of course, so now we've got 10 teams active in preseason. All the preseason rosters are out. So, first overall thoughts when you saw those rosters come through all the various emails, as opposed to one email that had all of them. You know, we got 10 different emails.
Yeah, I mean, a couple things stood out. One was FC Kansas City. I mean, you kind of knew that they had some problems with their attacking situation once Sydney Leroux was turned out to be pregnant, too. I mean, they have three forwards on their roster right now, and none of them are world-beating forwards. So you look at them and you think they've got to probably do something before the season starts if they want to be able to score goals. Chicago, of course, announced that Rachel Kwan's not coming back. I don't know if that was, I mean, it surprised some people, but of course she was one of the Canadians that was deallocated.
Right.
And the impression I have is that Chicago was happy to keep her and made an offer, but that she wanted to go explore her options elsewhere. Western New York threw a little bit of a surprise by not having Lady Andrade on their roster, which was an oversight mistake. She actually is there in training. And then
this was the only press release that didn't identify who was a trialist, who was a draftee, who was a national teamer. It was just like, here are the people.
Yeah, some teams did. I mean, this is the same story year in, year out. I mean, there's not one standard, so some teams do a good job of it. Some teams don't do such a great job of it. And then you have stuff like, you know, the Lady Andrade thing, or Sky Blue sends out a list that does not have Caroline Stanley on it when everybody knows she's there. She was in pictures. And then, of course, later on in the day, they announced that they signed her to a contract. So overall, my impression is there's not as many non-roster invites as there were last year.
Right.
I think Houston in particular had a lot of non-roster invites last year, maybe 18 or so. This year it's about 11. Portland hardly has any. I think they have four, which, by the way, their roster that they've announced is only 21 players, including those four non-roster invites. So that'll be interesting what they're going to do between now and the start of the season.
Does that tell you that they probably have, you know, players that they're going to sign that just, you know, they haven't finished the paperwork for?
Yeah, you would think so. And they still have a couple of international slots left to work with. They have, of course, there's been the announcement, not confirmed yet by Portland, that they've signed Amandine Henry from Lyon. But, of course, the thing there is her contract runs through the end of June. So it's possible, you know, it's possible that they could work out a deal with Lyon where they'll release her to Portland immediately. That will be interesting to see. Otherwise, she's not there probably until after the Olympics. But they have six international slots total, three in use, not including Henri. So they have three they could work with there. So there could be announcements coming that way. But I mean, at this stage of the preseason, really, besides the people who are on your preseason roster, picking up players that have been waived from other teams or the internationals, there's not a lot of players that you're going to go out and find who are going to be difference makers for you.
And everybody's already had open tryouts, right? I mean,
yeah.
If there's been someone that could be identified, they've probably been identified a la Monashim or like Cammy Privet for the dash.
Yeah, and I mean, you'll see movement. Like last year, there was movement. I know there were a handful of players who started out the preseason with Houston, for example, that went to Western New York, other places. There were players from FC Kansas City that came here. So players will move around, realizing that they're not going to get a full-time roster spot with a team. They'll move looking to see if they can get one somewhere else. So, you know, so we're not done with movement yet by any stretch of the imagination, but in terms of non-international players, you know, players who don't require an international slot, you're not, other than the names that you see on the list right now, you're not likely to see anything new pop up.
And then we know, you know, we're not going to have the U.S. national team players for the entire preseason, you know, that we've seen a peak at their schedule. How do you think that impacts, you know, the preseason tempo for the teams that have, you know, a fair amount of national teamers, U.S. national teamers?
I think it's frustrating. I mean, that's the downside of what Portland's done this year, is they have a lot of U.S. national team players at this stage. You know, it's frustrating for those teams. It makes it difficult to develop any coherence whatsoever heading into the regular season. They'll have them for, you know, they're starting to roll into town between now and Thursday. They can practice from Friday. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, there's no official announcement on this yet, but my understanding is that they're going to go into camp before the Columbia games, and that would mean that they're leaving by like the 25th of this month. So that Portland tournament, for example, which starts around the end of the month, that those players would not be available for that tournament. And it's, you ask yourself why. I mean, why does the national team need to have a camp for the Columbia games? And I hope they change their mind. I mean, there hasn't, like I said, there's been no formal announcement yet. I'm keeping my fingers crossed they change their mind about that, because it doesn't make any sense whatsoever to me that they would go into camp. And it hurts the teams. It hurts the league. It hurts the coherence of those teams heading into the first game of the season.
And a camp is what you need when players haven't been playing.
Yeah.
You know, and if they've had, you know, they had their January camp, you had February CONCACAF Olympic qualifying, you've had She Believes, then they return to their clubs, have preseason with their clubs. It's not like they need a lot of warm-up for those matches against Colombia. I mean, what this league and the previous leagues were supposed to do was create an environment so players are match fit at the drop of a hat. And you know I reference the old days a lot, but I can remember the first international games that the U.S. national team played after the kickoff of the WSA in 2001, and it was a really short camp, and they played Canada twice in like a 5-day period, but they all talked about how different it was, because when they came to camp, they were all incredibly fit, as opposed to they were used to these long breaks between playing games, and you'd have to stay fit on your own. And they just talked about how great it was, where it's like, hey, you've been in a highly competitive training environment. You didn't need 4 or 5 days to ramp up for a friendly.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's definitely an old school approach to things. It's an approach that's appropriate to when you don't have a league.
Right.
And I'm sure U.S. soccer looks at the 10 teams in this league, and not all 10 are equally professional.
True.
In their training setup and how they do things. And that's probably what they have in mind. But you're right. I mean, these players really have not had a break since, I can't remember when.
Yeah.
With all the friendlies they've had, with all you know, the league, with all the camp, it just seems so unnecessary to pull them out of preseason with their teams, and have a camp at this stage. It's really, I don't understand. I really don't understand it.
I would really say in the past year and a half, the only time they've had off is this past November between the Victory Tour games. Other than that, it's been full on, you know, since like mid-2014, you know, that's almost 2 years, really.
Yeah.
And I would be more supportive of, okay, the national teamers, they're not in preseason because they're resting.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that's a concern, and that's a valid concern on Jill Ellis's part of how much travel they're doing or how much training they're doing as you're prepping for the Olympics. And I know that was something that was considered last year, you know, like, you know, I know that, you know, Randy Waldrum told Carly Lloyd she didn't have to travel back to Houston when the team was just going to turn around and go back to the Northeast.
Yeah.
You know, so to kind of like save her a flight and, you know, that kind of stuff. So I would be much more supportive of that, of like, hey, they don't have to report till, you know, March 22nd so that they all get those extra 5 days off, as opposed to hearing that there's another camp. But what are we going to do?
Yeah, apparently nothing.
Yeah. Same old, same old. But it does look like, you know, all teams will, all players will report to their teams, you know, for opening day. We haven't heard yet when, you know, players in the Olympics will depart. You know, I'm sure it's going to be different depending on which country. But I do like, it should be a much longer stretch since the Olympics is later, that all of the national teamers are with their clubs.
Yeah, and they're all, I mean, we know Australia has said they've released their players to go join their NWSL teams, and apparently they're not going to reconvene for camp until 2 weeks before the Olympics starts, which is ideal. I mean, I think that's the way to go. There was some thought that Australia might do a residency like they did last year, but really letting the players go play in a league and be competitive and training nonstop instead of just training with themselves like you do in a residency camp is a much better way for these teams to plan things going forward. It's the players come in, I think, in better match shape. I look at Abby Wambach. I never really thought when Abby Wambach last year took off from NWSL, I never really thought that she was match sharp in any of the games after she made that decision.
Right.
When she came on as a substitute, or whether she started for the U.S. So having those games under their belt, there's really something to be said for that. Hopefully the U.S. won't go in the camp too early. Hopefully Canada won't go in a camp too early.
Yeah, and Canada announced they've got two home matches. That'll be their send-off for Rio. They'll be hosting Brazil twice in June, and they're going to play in the Netherlands on April 10th. So thankfully that's, you know, before the NWSL season starts. It does help that the NWSL schedule seems to have respected all of the FIFA windows for these games. So
yeah,
you kind of know that these games are being played at a time when, for the most part, there's not league games.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, any last thoughts about NWSL rosters? I mean, like you said, there's a lot of movement to come. This is only the beginning. You know, rosters don't have to be finalized to that final 20 until, like, what, the Monday before this first
yes,
game?
Somewhere right around there. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's great to have everybody back. It's good to see things rolling again.
The long off season is over.
Yeah, we're a month. You know, you look at the calendar. We're a month from the opening weekend of matches. So hallelujah, we're back.
Well, and I also want to ask you about a league on the other side of the world, the WK League. You've done some great initial coverage for keepernotes.com, and you know, we have the first Korean signing in NWSL this year. So talk about, you know, what movement we might see from WK League to NWSL, and also you'd mentioned some Australians maybe playing in Korea.
Yeah, you know, WK League, we've talked about before, and like you said, we have some coverage on Keeper Notes, and my plan is to try to do a weekly column on WK League this year, because it's a league, I have long ties to Korea, it's a league that I like. The matches are available on YouTube, streamed on YouTube, most of them, not all of them. But it's a league that's growing. It's been around for a while. It's getting stronger and stronger, and that's shown in the national team performance. You know, the slaughter fest that was the Olympic qualifying earlier this month Korea, they didn't qualify for the Olympics, but they did really well. I mean, they were tough to beat. Nobody ran over them, and that's very much due to this league. So, yeah, Jung Ga-ul is the first player from first Korean period, but first player from WK League to come to the U.S. this year, playing for Western New York. You also have a player who I know real well, Cho Seol-hyun, who is a national team captain who wanted to come to NWSL, but just didn't work out. She's decided to go on loan for 1 year to Japan. You have Ji So-hyun with Chelsea in England. You're going to start seeing, I think, more and more of these players going overseas because there's a lot of really great technical, athletic talent that's available there. And conversely, as the Koreans try to grow that league and make it stronger and stronger so that it develops even better players for the national team, they're bringing in more international players. And the team that's won the championship for the past couple seasons has had two very good Brazilians who are on the national team, Bia and Tice. They've added an Australian for this year, Amy Jackson. Suwon FC, who made the playoffs last year, they lost their leading goal scorer, the league-leading goal scorer, actually, from Romania to one of their competitors. So they went out and they got Ayo. Everybody remembers Ayo for the Portland Thorns last year. She struggled in NWSL. It's a bit harsh on her that she only had 1 year because she was a great goal scorer in Germany with Turbina Potsdam. But she's there. You have Hannah Bromley, and Hannah Bromley's from New Zealand. Hannah Bromley and Gemma Simon are both with Suwon FMC as well. And then you have Rachel Quigley from Australia, who is playing for Hwachon KSPO this year. So that's three Australians, one Kiwi, all four of them from W League, IO, a couple Brazilians. There's a few other foreigners over there as well. And it's just it's a fun league that you really can't find any English language coverage on. Going to do that this year. I'm going to try.
You're the man. You're the man. You're the WK League man.
Yeah, it's you know, like I said, I think you'll see. I know personally, I know 3, 4, 5 Koreans who would love to come play in NWSL. I think if Jun does well for Western New York, which I think she will, she has to adjust to the pace and power of the league, of course, but she certainly has the technical skill set and the goal scoring pedigree. If she does well, I think you'll see more teams looking at Korea as a source of players, because Korea does want to push these players overseas to get them more experience to, again, build the strength of the national team.
Now, does the WK League run the same calendar as NWSL, roughly?
Yeah, just longer. So the opening weekend of games was this past Monday, and the championship game is in early November.
Gotcha. Now, would they have taken a break for the Olympics if South Korea had made the Olympics?
I have to go back and look at the schedule, whether they were taking a break or not. Usually, like, they took off the World Cup, for example.
Gotcha.
So I would expect that the schedule does have the Olympics off and the off chance that they had made it.
Well, Hal, thanks for all that you do for the Dash and also other coverage for KeeperNotes.com. And, of course, we'll be talking to you soon as the season approaches.
Great. Thanks for having me.
All right, time to wrap it up with the back four. The Olympic field is set at last. We know the 12 teams for the 2016 Women's Olympic Soccer Tournament. Sweden won the final European berth with 2 wins and a tie in the tournament against Norway, Netherlands, and Switzerland. The official draw is set for April 14th in Rio, and then we'll know which teams will play in which groups. For a look back at the teams that have qualified for all the previous Women's Olympic tournaments, check out KeeperNotes.com. Next, winners. Lots of winners. Canada won its first Algarve Cup with a 2-1 win over Brazil. USA, of course, won the inaugural She Believes Cup with a 2-1 scoreline against Germany. And Austria beat Poland to win the Cyprus Cup last week with a scoreline of 2-1. And speaking of more winners, the under-17 CONCACAF Women's Championship wrapped up in Grenada on Sunday, with the USA winning regional bragging rights over Mexico with a 2-1 win in the final. Canada, meanwhile, beat Haiti 4-2 in the third-place match, so the CONCACAF teams for next fall's under-17 Women's World Cup in Jordan are USA, Mexico, and Canada. For highlights of the tournament, check out CONCACAF's YouTube page. Last but not least, the 2015 U.S. Women's National Team jerseys have officially been retired. I still have a few in stock in various sizes at my store, so if you're looking for a three-star World Cup jersey, email me at Jen, J-E-N, at soccerforall.com, and that's the number four. The launch date for the new kits will be March 24th. That's when it'll be available for sale. Nike might tease the image before that, but March 24th is the first day you can buy it. And the U.S. women will wear them for the first time against Colombia on April 6th. All right, that's it for this edition of the Mixed Zone Women's Soccer Podcast. If you're not already subscribed via iTunes, you can subscribe that way, or Podomatic, TuneIn, Stitcher. You can find the podcast at howlermagazine.com. Just whatever you do, make sure you're listening. And as always, thanks to PK Ray for making this podcast possible.